civil bastard.
Me?
Hello, and welcome to episode 143 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other survivors as masterpieces. I am Nick, the priest having trouble with his faith of the podcast, and I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
A good cop, a manly cop.
And today we are discussing 1972's... who was the director of this?
I'm not sure who directed it. It was not somebody particularly known for...
Well, so it hasn't sprung to my mind particularly, which they normally do. It was a Lou Grade production, presumably.
Yeah.
It definitely looked like one. Regardless, we are talking about Ronald Neame.
Who also did...
Beyond the Poseidon Adventure.
He was nominated for 3 Oscars.
Oh, really?
Over his career.
Sorry, Ronald.
He wrote Great Expectations, 1948. He wrote Brief Encounter.
I don't think he wrote Great Expectations. I've limited literary skills.
The 48 film of it.
We should do Brief Encounter someday. But nevertheless, today we are doing 1972's The Poseidon Adventure. A disaster movie, not quite the first disaster movie, but one of the ones that kicked off the kind of 70s craze of disaster movies.
I think it would be fair to say that the first of those was Airport.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there were others. This is not going to be a comprehensive review. We have previously talked about this a little when we talked about Airplane.
Yes.
Which was one of the things that killed the string of not the only one.
Well, we probably will mention Airplane again at some point during this podcast.
Yeah. We've got Airport in 70, we've got this in 72, Earthquake in 74, The Towering Inferno also 74.
Well, I always thought The Towering Inferno was the one that triggered all this stuff, but no, that was quite late in towards the end of the disaster movie craze. We had a brief kind of resurgence in the 90s, particularly with enviro disasters and multiple asteroids about to hit the Earth films.
Mm.
But this was really the apotheosis of disaster films around about this time. And The Poseidon Adventure was in the vanguard.
Yeah, it's an interesting style. I mean, one of the things that made it work in this era was that you could start a film without complete A-listers in it. You could have, you know, competent B-listers and several of them.
Well, yeah,
names that people would recognise, but who were not somebody who was expected to anchor a film on their own. So you do have a more of an ensemble piece. I can't remember who coined the phrase, but this was also known as a box picture because the boxes of the cameos of each character would be along the bottom of the poster.
Okay, yes, that makes sense. By the time of Towering Inferno, you're having Paul Newman and Steve McQueen, you know, literally fighting over who is the top of the poster.
Yeah, they eventually had invented a new way of doing credits with one of them at the top right and the other at the bottom left.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
We don't quite have that here. I mean, Gene Hackman is...
He's not a big star at this point.
Oh, he's off the... fresh off the French Connection at this point?
Just about.
I mean, he is, I gather, doing this for the money. But he does, I mean, it's an intro, so...
And it's not a small part he's got.
No, he's the lead insofar as we have a lead. It's an ensemble cast. Yeah. And they're all... it's tricky to know. I mean, this is exactly the era I was growing up. Not 1972, but by the time I was growing up, these were regular... Saturday afternoon films, all with characters that we recognize. I don't think we've had Ernest Borgnine. Borgnine, is that how you say it?
We haven't had him on a Ribbon of Memes before, as far as I know. I mean, I think I first saw him in The Black Hole.
Yes.
Which was Disney trying to cash in on Star Wars.
Maybe we should do The Black Hole one day.
He was a bit older then.
It has some problems. He crops up in a lot of films, old westerns.
And here I think he's just exiting his leading man phase and going into the slightly grizzled character actor phase.
Yes, that's fair. In fact, a lot of, apart from Gene Hackman, we have the excellently accented Roddy McDowall, who was English, so I don't know why he's so awful at doing Scott. It took me a while to work out he was doing a Scottish accent. I mean, I am no stranger to bad accents, but goodness me.
We've got two more Ribbon and Means returners. One on screen, which I think we'll talk about later, and one off, because this is John Williams composing.
Oh, is it? This is before he's found the John Williams, then, I think, because it sounds like standard film score to me.
Yes, I think that's fair.
Instead of I Am John Williams.
But on the other hand, this is John Williams in 1972 when he was still relatively cheap. So.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
And, yeah, so it's an interesting style. I think it has something in common with soap opera, in fact.
Yes.
Part of it, there is obviously the disaster plot and mass deaths and so on, but I think a lot of it is to put people in a tight situation so that they show their true colours.
Well, this is also...
Repeatedly.
I've seen a few films, like Hotel, or... They're all, I've forgotten his name, but they're either frozen in an airport, and it's all like famous actors like Richard Burton or Michael Caine crops up, or Maggie Smith. These films where they're all in an enclosed environment, and then it just lets the drama unfold.
Mm.
But this, and I think this is coming off the back of those. This is also slightly unbelievably, well, maybe not. It's right in the era of the American New Age, where we have Bonnie and Clyde and all these miserable... sorry, that's a terrible... different feeling films. But this is like standard Hollywood...
This is absolutely... And even by the standards of the day, it's please the crowds, pull in the bucks.
Yes.
Don't do anything dangerous or complicated.
Yes. But I agree. There is the strong kind of... Oh, I won't say deep character work, but there's like... Each character has at least... Two dimensions, which is often what we want for this kind
stripped
of film.
Stripped of most of my so-called clerical powers, but I'm still in business.
it's very Dan Brown, the way... Gene Hackman really struck me as the way he's like, I have got to get my... Not Gene Hackman himself, but the script is like, I have got to explain my character in this scene. This is the scene where I'm going to do this.
It actually reminded me a lot of that initial excavation scene in Jurassic Park.
Yes.
Where we're meeting the leads.
I think that's probably more competently done.
Yes, but it
is Spielberg, wouldn't it?
It's off in the same direction from yes. neutral filmmaking. That's what I'm after. Yeah.
So briefly, the plot, because it's not going to take too long. The Poseidon is
based on a novel by Paul Gallico, who actually wrote some good stuff. I haven't read this novel.
Well, so
his genie, I would strongly recommend. It's the story of a cat.
Oh, I like the sound of that. You wouldn't have thought this was based on... No,
that's the thing. A lot of these films, they were very much... there has been a book, and we will buy the rights to make a blockbuster out of it because it's in the right general area of material.
Which, you know, that makes me think a bit of Die Hard. But Die Hard took it and, I don't know, made something... that's almost a disaster.
Drops a lot of rubbish out of it.
Yes.
I think it does inherit from something. We're saying this is not brilliant. This is not a film to rule the world or anything. But the reason we're talking about it is because it and its kin have been hugely influential.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Its DNA runs deep into Hollywood. The plot is that... and stop me if you've heard this one before. There is a cruise ship heading across... Presumably it's the Atlantic as they're heading towards either Spain or Israel or somewhere, or France, somewhere in that direction. And it's about to be mothballed when it gets there, but the greedy corporate guy in charge tells the captain he's got to go faster. Every day we don't get this ship scrapped, costs us another $50,000 or whatever.
That wasn't meant to be going on. I think I may have missed that bit.
Okay, right. But he forces the captain to go faster, and then a huge rogue wave. Well,
it's the product of an undersea earthquake.
But tsunamis don't work like that when you're in the sea, as far as I'm aware. Rogue waves are a thing, but it's the product of a tsunami.
And
then,
as I understand, the tsunami at sea is basically a big swell.
Yeah, basically you go up a lot and then you go down a lot, but you don't get tipped over. Regardless, a rogue wave, I think, is a thing that can happen. I'm not an oceanologist. But anyway, the cruise, I think it's a cruise ship.
Yes.
It certainly seems to be given the clientele on board.
But by this date, that's part of the thing. The book was only a few years old. It's a 69 novel, but even by then, most people crossing the Atlantic would take a plane.
Right, yes.
I don't think the 747's in service yet, but it will be within the next few years, and the earlier ones definitely are.
So if you are going by boat, you're doing it for the leisure aspect.
Or you're old-fashioned, or you want to be a bit more luxurious, that kind of thing. But it's a choice.
So they're celebrating, it's New Year's Eve, they're all celebrating, we're introduced to our characters. Gene Hackman as the priest, whose name, I mean, the names are somewhat...
Of sect, definitely not specified, because, I mean, that's fair enough. It's you don't want to be, you don't want to get specific about things. He is some sort of Christian-type priest.
He is, and he's, it's hard not to let, he's kind of like, he's basically a maverick cop, but he's a priest.
he actually believes in this stuff. And we get this little speech where he gets to deliver the sermon of the day or whatever it is.
Yes.
And he's basically saying, don't just pray and wait for God to bail you out of whatever your situation is. Go and do something about it.
Yeah, he's a dynamic go-getter priest. It's kind of the opposite of that joke where someone's in, where a priest is captured, his ship's capsizes and he's in the dinghy and then a helicopter comes aboard over ahead and he says, oh no, God will provide, don't worry, I won't rescue you. Eventually he starves to death, and he says to St. Peter, why didn't you send someone to save me? And he says, well, I think the helicopter would... Anyway, he's the opposite of that because he thinks God likes those who help... God helps those who help themselves.
I wouldn't put it quite that bluntly, but it is basically... Yeah, the way God acts is by letting you succeed in the right things that you do rather than by, you know, handing you a plate of biscuits or whatever.
Well, I think, Roger, we've already delved far deeper into theology than the film does. The film basically sets him up as a maverick.
But definitely a good guy.
Damn it, priest, I'm going to get this job done, whether you like it or not. But yeah,
if he were a Catholic, he would be the good sort of Catholic, not the creaky old men in the Vatican sort of Catholic.
Exactly. He would
and equivalent for other Christian sects.
He would look down upon them for sure. We have the... Ernest Borgnine and his wife. Which actress is that?
Stella Stevens as Linda, and his character is he's a grizzled cop, and her character is she was a prostitute.
Yeah, and we get a nice. This feels to me less.
And he kept arresting her to keep her off the streets until he could convince her to marry him. And because he's Ernest Borgnine, this is not creepy.
He sells it. It's a sweet scene, isn't it? Rather than a disturbing, episode of police corruption. And we get all these little vignettes of all these characters, just long enough to establish their characters. Some work better than others for me. I quite like the Ernest Borgnine and Stella little moment where she's seasick. I don't know, they have a bit of a comedy shtick that goes well together. I really thought the Gene Hackman one, I felt like he was acting too hard for the scene that it was. He's an incredible actor, of course, and the script didn't deserve it. So I struggled a bit with that. We have the annoying slash not annoying. We've had a few annoying kids that weren't annoying in films previously. I think in this film...
He's pretty annoying.
He's quite annoying, yeah. I was going to say, in this one, this is not that type of film.
But he has an older sister who's hot, so that's all right.
But I was going to leave this to Lenny, but it turns out all the hot young girls in this film, you couldn't possibly climb in that skirt. You'll have to rip your skirt off. Everyone else is climbing in dinner jackets and slacks and slip-on shoes, but no, you couldn't do that. Just take your skirt off.
we should also mention the elderly Jewish couple going to see their son, who's just had a grandson.
So that, he's had a son, it's their grandson. They haven't met him before. That's,
Jack Albertson and Shirley Winters.
Shirley Winters, of course. Shirley Winters. Yes. It's a hard one to watch this for me because I haven't watched it for a long time, but it feels so familiar from like Saturday afternoons when I was a kid that it, in some ways it's lost its sense of danger and excitement. I didn't know it very well, but just the whole feeling was familiar.
I think because to some extent this is establishing the template, and as we've said, there were early disaster films, Airport was a big one, but this, if you have seen disaster films from before or after this period, before or after this specific film, there are very, very few surprises, if any.
Yeah. I mean, it's
one of them is that repeating Ribbon and Beam's cast member we haven't missed yet, haven't mentioned yet, because the disaster only happens about a quarter of the way through. So, let us talk about the bridge.
Well, there was an opening quote for a reason. We have Leslie Nielsen in the twilight of his career, or so he thought at that time, playing it absolute. Now, I'm quite familiar with Forbidden Planet. In some ways, it's easier to watch Leslie Nielsen there as a straight man, because he doesn't quite look like Leslie Nielsen in The Naked Gun and Airplane, for instance.
But this is definitely Airplane Leslie Nielsen.
This is that Leslie Nielsen playing because
that is going to be, 8 years later that he makes that.
And so the way he's delivering the lines is exactly how he delivers them in Airplane.
Well, go and listen to that episode, but I think we established then that he was told to deliver it straight as a dramatic role.
Yes, he's supposed to be the guy who's not aware he's in a comedy.
Yeah.
And here, he's not aware he's in a comedy, but he isn't in a comedy, so
that's a matter of opinion.
Well, so it's really hard to watch him take him seriously. I mean, he does a very competent job, but he was a much funnier man than he was ever given credit for in this kind of thing, and he's really good in the straight roles in comedies that he got later. I mean, he did some terrible comedies later, but here,
this is not trying to be comedy. But it is definitely trying to be overwrought.
Yes, it's melodramatic. I mean,
that can fall into funny if the melodrama doesn't convince, and for me it doesn't always convince.
It's exactly the sort of film that Airplane was taking the piss out of.
Absolutely. I mean, Airport obviously even more, but yes.
Yes, that's exactly why they got someone like Leslie Nielsen in it, because they wanted people from these films to be in their film. It even has a kid coming up to the bridge, and I half expected Leslie Nielsen to say, do you like gladiator movies? but no, it's played absolutely straight. And so we have the introduction of all these characters, and then, not too long into the film. It's not a hugely long film, but it's not too long. The ship just basically gets turned upside down. There's a rogue wave, capsizes the ship, it doesn't come back up again. Oh, no. And from that point on, we never really know what happens to anyone else, but we're focused on the people who were in the dining room at the time.
Yeah.
And the whole, I mean, it's really cool start.
It's not a super plausible situation. I mean, I don't know ships of that date, but yes, there's a lot of mass on top. Not so much on this one, in fact. But they are not going to be stable floating upside down, particularly in rough weather. So.
No, it seems to be very calm weather almost immediately as soon as it capsizes. But also it uses a lot of air underneath. I think they do tend to pop straight back up again for the most part.
They probably wouldn't be fully self-righting because you need to compromise a lot of other things that are designed for that. I would expect it to end up floating on its side.
Yes, on its side. I mean, to me, the image is like of the Herald of Free Enterprise, kind of thing. But it's absolutely upside down, which is really cool because, that means every set, even though, frankly, it does look a bit like a cheap film if you take a step back. What it means is every set is interesting because the floor's the ceiling and the ceiling's the floor, and it's...
It's interesting because I think probably the best of those is the dining room.
Yes, I agree.
They, I don't know whether they actually built a set big enough to be to be the dining room, but also be rotated. I'm not sure they.
I meant to investigate this because it certainly looked like that was what was happening.
But it's a very good illusion if they didn't.
Yeah.
And the brilliance of this, and he does have its moments of brilliance. Yeah. I think a lot of it is in the set design and special effects.
Yes.
Particularly that initial tumble when the ship is slowly capsizing, slowly enough that people are thinking, you know, if I hold on to this, I'll be fine. Oh dear, I'm now holding on to a thing that's on the ceiling.
Now, yes, I'm 30, 40, 50 feet away from the what was the ceiling. Yes, it's a really nice moment. And suddenly our characters are in great peril. And it's a real, I mean, the whole film is basically, I forget who said it, but basically, make characters you like and then put them through hell, basically. And that's to make an interesting narrative. Well, the disaster movie is the purest form of that. You have these interesting characters, interesting is maybe a stretch, but characters you like, and then suddenly...
You have these characters with things that concern them, things they want to do, things they want to change about the world,
yes.
And then you put them in a situation where the rules are not applying, except whatever rules they choose to keep.
Yes, exactly. Basically, either... it becomes life or death. You know, either you get to the end of this scene or you die. And so it's hard not to feel compelled by this pure narrative. Almost immediately, everyone who was all in their dinner jackets then suddenly looked scuffed up and covered in oil or whatever from the whole film.
Whole day's sauce, the horror.
Gene Hackman then leaps to the fore as his priest. What's his character called?
Reverend Scott.
Reverend Scott. Thank you. Reverend Scott immediately, and he's slightly a Mary Sue character. He knows this is a terrible place to be, and the way to be, even though it's not immediately clear to me what's great about being at the top with an inch thick of steel above you, but I can see his point. It's probably better there than...
Well, if there is going to be rescue, the rescue is presumably going to apply to the part of the ship that is above water.
It seems likely, but he's so goddamn sure about it. He knows you have to go.
This is the kid's secondary role is to dispense information about the ship.
Yes.
Because he has been ship nogging, which frankly I find entirely realistic. So he is aware that is the thinnest part of the hull and so on.
Yeah, so they can't get out themselves, but they're hoping when they get there, they'll think of something, or they'll get rescued at that point. So they...
And they don't have any other options, that's the other thing.
Well, either they stay there, as the ship's purser says that they should, or they clamber up a convenient Christmas tree, a conveniently iron-framed Christmas tree, I think, or steel-framed, and they clamber up to... I mean, if anything would put you off doing that, it'd be Roddy McDowell's Scottish accent at the top.
Oh, was it Scottish?
I think it was Scottish, yes. we haven't talked about Roddy McDowell. I love Roddy McDowell. He's in all the terrible films I used to watch. obviously, I've mainly seen him in Planet of the Apes and those films, but he's unrecognisable in those as he's an ape. But he is a crew member who helps them up to the top. He's hurt his leg, but he'll be all right. Don't worry. And then we have basically from then on, it's peril. Peril, peril in this scene. This is the thing you have to get past.
Where I think it falls slightly is that there isn't really a sense of progress because once they've got out of the inhabited spaces of the ship, obviously the sets get cheaper to design because it's basically an industrial space with some pipes and stuff and some flames.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't have to look like a recognisable thing inverted.
Well, that's the thing. You're right. The dining room looks incredible upside down. It looks like this alien weird thing. Everywhere else just looks like a corridor for the most part because that's what they're in. And the corridor looks much the same upside down as it does the right way up. But then we have, you know, this is a classic thing as well. You know, we have peril that assaults the characters from without, and then we have the inter-party conflict within. Ernest Borgnine's angry. He's got to be angry. He's Ernest Borgnine. and he's angry with Reverend Scott. Scott knows he's right, and of course he is right. I find that a bit frustrating. I like the fact there are some moments where he's given some slight moments of doubt, but he's never really doubtful that he's doing the right thing.
They do run into another party that's trying to get to moved towards the bows, though we're not clear what they're trying to do there either.
No. I mean, their whole plan is to keep going up and back. And that's the rest of the film, really, is that they go up and back and they go up and back.
And this door is jammed and we can't get through here. We have to go a different way.
Well, let's have an argument. Oh, okay.
We have to swim through this flooded passage. As a gamer, one thing I very much admire is the GM of this scenario has a convenient tool to get them moving when they're arguing too much, which is the water is getting closer.
Yes. Yeah, either there's a boom from the funnels underneath, or the water comes out. Yeah, it's dynamic, it's interesting. Also, you could tell it's been GM'd by a character. Everyone gets their chance to shine. Well, maybe I'm being mean about it. Basically, Shelley Winters gets to use her, this will execute your character at the end, but this is your one use trait thing. She was a good swimmer. So they get to the engine room, or close to the engine room, which is blocked, and they have to swim some distance and out again. The Reverend Scott gets caught for an improbably long time. Shelley Winters used to be champion swimmer. She swims under, frees him, gets back out again, and then as a plot-related heart attack, I think, drops dead. Spoilers.
Shall I just do the hand in the money? A is for Akers, who fell down a vent. B is for Bell, whose heart was all spent. L is for Linda, who slipped on the steel. S is for Scott, who dropped from a wheel. Gashly Crumb Tiny's photos, images to be inserted later. But...
Oh, it's very... Well, that summarises it, really, yes. That we have... Yes, I forgot to say Akers, Roddy McDowell, fell into a bit... Most of the deaths, apart from the heart attack, have been falling into waters on fire simultaneously. But
oily water, fair enough, I guess.
Yeah. Anyway, they don't come back, so presumably they're dead. Linda is the wife of Ernest Borgnine's character, who also just falls up.
She's climbing across a slightly tricky thing when an explosion happens.
Yes, it's very... it's a compelling... Oh, I hope these people make it. I mean,
that's the crucial thing.
Yes.
Even Rogo, the argumentative cop, we like these people, at least to the extent of, I hope they succeed, I hope they survive.
Yes.
Rather than a film which may in fact be the subject of our next episode. we'll get back to that. But anyway.
Well, let's go to our old favourite, Uncut Gems, where we obviously... Was it Uncut Gems? I think it was... you've got to care about the character first and foremost.
Yeah, and it may be crude, but it works.
It's pure basic narrative, but it works. And it's...
I'll quote Gary Arnold from the Washington Post's Contemporary Review. Strictly formula hokum, but reasonably diverting if one doesn't ask for more than the filmmaker's care to give. That is, for imaginative writing and direction. As usual, only the special effects and set designers and stuntmen have been permitted to be playful and creative.
I think everyone who's in it sells it. And I think,
they are very much channeled to their roles. I don't think anybody's is being an amazing actor here and doing a unique thing that the director didn't think of.
Nobody's doing a Billy Bob Thornton in A Simple Plan, are they? Really? they're all doing, what is expected. They've all been hired because that's who they are and that's what we want you to do.
Yeah.
It worked. The long story short, they get to the hull and they are cut out by the French Coast Guard who rescue them. There aren't really any twists on the way. They don't have to suddenly change their plan particularly or anything. They're just like, oh, this room's full of fire or this room's full of smoke. Gene Hackman gets his very nice, sacrifice. He jumps onto a presumably white hot or red hot wheel and turns it to turn off the steam before his hands give way and he drops heroically into the sea.
Well, also he can jump to get there, but there's no way he can get up the momentum to swim back.
Yes,
that's quite effectively visually portrayed. You can see, it doesn't need to be said, oh, but you can't get back from that. You can see it looking at it. That
yes, no one's screaming at him, how are you going to get back, Reverend? It's just, yes, that's a nice visual sense. In a way, I would have liked kind of close-ups on his blistering hands or something to show
him. I'm not completely sure it's meant to be hot.
Well, that's what I was wondering about. I mean, he's closing it because it's boiling hot for everyone else. I assumed it was boiling hot for him as well, but he doesn't react in that. Maybe I misread that then. Maybe it isn't. Anyway, because I agree, he doesn't.
I mean, it would make sense if it were, but
I don't think
the film shows it as being. That was the impression I got, at least.
I just assumed he was being tough guy and didn't.
one moment I'd like to mention. So, Manny, Belle's husband, has come through the swim and discovers that she has died. And basically wants to be left alone to die with her.
Mm.
And I wrote this down in all caps as, use medallion with Manny.
Yes.
Because Belle gave the Father Scott, Reverend Scott, I'm sorry, the medallion that they were collectively going to give to their son/grandson.
It's
now you've got to carry this on.
It's very by the numbers, isn't it? But it works. I'm not sure what more to say.
Well, one thing did strike me that I was a little surprised that nobody mentioned it was, okay, you are surviving because you've got this bubble of trapped air in what was the bottom of the hull. Surely when that lat is cut, all the air is going to get out and the water is all going to rush up at once.
Yes.
It doesn't happen, but B, you could justify it not happening with something about watertight doors and so on. It's just a little surprising to me that nobody says it, because it seems to me a fairly obvious thing to think of.
Well, it also would have, partly, when they're in the dining room, it would have made sense if he'd said something about that at some point, but, Anyway, it's...
Just one note on the difference with the book, because they are explicitly told in this that there were no other survivors.
They are at the end of this. That isn't
in
quite...
the film, yeah. Now, in the book there are the survivors. The party going to the bow did actually get out some.
Oh, do they? Okay.
Which I think lessens the effect of the whole, I am convinced that I am right and this is the only way to live.
That would have been a better ending in a way to me. Or at least, if they'd got out and seen the other survive. Yeah, that would have been interesting. I would have liked that. But maybe that's a bit more modern. Maybe they just wanted it more black and white for this film.
I think so. But other things are shuffled around and you've got similar characters, but stuff's been changed around and similar things happen to different people. It's all basically the same stuff in a different configuration, which I think is probably a fairly standard film treatment thing.
I don't feel particularly compelled to read the book, having watched the film. Yeah. It's one of those films I watched, not regularly, but maybe I'd seen it two or three times before as a kid. The image that is in my mind is the upside down Poseidon, so the hull floating on the sea, and the other image is Gene Hackman holding onto the wheel and dropping into the sea, and that's probably the iconic image from the film, if there is an iconic image. I didn't remember much else about it, and I probably won't in 3 or 4 years either. It's good. I like it.
Yeah, I enjoyed this one more than The Towering Inferno, which I last watched a few years ago. It also has good stuff. I like it, but this, I think it may be because it's an ensemble piece, but it's a small ensemble piece.
Towering Inferno is a bit too sprawling. Sort of
8 to 10 of the initial party of survivors.
I don't think it's much more than 8 actually, but you're right. It feels small. So if I'm wrong there, it's because it feels small.
Whereas Towering Inferno, we've got a lot more, and each of them has their own little plot that has to play out.
They never really come together. It's a lot more cutting from what it's slightly more common.
I mean, the Towering Inferno does have a very aged Fred Astaire, but that's not a point in its favour.
I liked it. Yeah. He's good in that. It has Robert Duvall. I always like Robert Duvall. Not Robert Duvall. Anyway, doesn't matter. Him.
Also, icon of 70s man and Stephen Quinn.
Yeah, I'm less of a fan of. I think we talked about this with Thomas Crown Affair.
Yeah.
I prefer Paul Newman. But anyway, there we go. Who seemed to be a nicer person?
And you, of course, did the extra credit assignment on this film.
I watched the Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, for which I need to say later.
As I understand it, it's basically some of the survivors are going back in for reasons.
Not those survivors. No, the film starts with Michael Caine as a skipper of a ship in financial trouble, and he sees the helicopter with the survivors on it flying overhead. And he's like, what's that? Oh, I don't know why he's Australian in this particular clip. But then Sally Field crops up, and, Kurt Waldheim? I've forgotten his name. Kurt Waldum? Waldo Curtin. Anyway, you would know him if you saw his, Roger will find it for me. But the idea is, Michael Caine is like, that obviously means there's a ship stranded somewhere. I want all the money from that because I'm desperate for money. We're going to go straight to the purser's office. We'll nip in, get the money.
There's something about valuable cargo, I think.
Well, he doesn't know that at the time, but he just thinks there's got to be some salvage there. They sail over to the ship. They find the hole that our survivors just got out of, and they go back into the ship. Telly Savalas,
which allows them to reuse some of the stock footage, which
always ends. Telly Savalas turns up as a philanthropist who's here to help. Turns out, spoilers, he's not a philanthropist at all. I did my own little mnemonic for Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, which is T is for Telly, with his goggle-eyed grin. M is for Michael, who's phoning it in.
Now, I've got to admit, I've seen Michael Caine in some utter garbage.
Yes.
Including The Swarm, which I highly recommend. Is it The Swarm or The Bees? I think it's The Swarm.
I think it is The Swarm.
But I have always seen him doing a full professional job.
That's why I was disappointed with this. I feel like he's really not interested. I mean, it's then, from that point on, they get stuck in the ship. And then it's a rerun of this Poseidon Adventure, except, frankly, with less likable characters. And that is ultimately the problem. You don't like the characters as much. And so it just doesn't work as well. Plus, you've already seen the same thing. It has some plot twist.
I'm just reminded of the thing authors of series hate to hear from their publishers. The fans want another that's just the same, only different.
Yes. Well, it is just the same, only different, but it's somehow less good. There are plot twists, which there are none to note in the Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah, I've got to say, there are no surprises. At the point where they say, okay, we have to climb through the ship, there are basically no further
surprises.
That's
how it happens. Whereas here it turns out Telly Savalas is not what he thought he was. I'll let you watch it if you want to. It turns out there is more cargo in the ship than you were expecting, which is why Telly Savalas turns up. and if that entices you enough to watch it, then go with my blessing. But it's not as good as the Poseidon Adventure. As far as the Poseidon Adventure goes, that's a tricky one. It's very hard to call it a masterpiece.
Is it very, very good? Well, no. I think one has to acknowledge its influence on other things, and as I say, that's why we talked about it in the first place, but also why I think it could potentially raise as a masterpiece. I don't think it is.
It is a template for a lot of things. And yeah. As I say, its DNA runs deep.
It is itself following templates, but it's gathering a lot of them together and putting them in one convenient package.
You are going to have a good time watching the Poseidon Adventure, unless you don't care about any of the characters, which is your own problem, I guess, but
it's a thing I often say about modern films, that they don't go to any trouble to let you feel positive about the characters before they start putting them in peril, and this does do that job.
It does, by the numbers, but it's kind of a, I don't know, well, that's the thing, is it a pinnacle of the form? In a way it is, it's just the form is kind of cheap.
Yeah.
Well, not cheap, the form is kind of, the audience are going to love this. And it's hard to kind of admire, but on another way, it's hard not to admire. It's a tricky one for me.
I'm just being reminded of the film Rose the Titanic, when it was suggested that it would have been cheaper to lower the Atlantic.
Another Lou Grade special. It's also in my comfort zone a bit, because it is of that era, of the actors of that generation. in films that were always on the telly when I was growing up. There was always a film with one of these actors or someone of that generation. And so to me, it's kind of safe. And maybe that lessens the impact in a way. It feels like relaxing and reminds me of my childhood and isn't quite...
It wasn't quite that kind of fixture, because by the time it was on television for me, I was a bit older. But,
Well,
it's definitely... I saw posters of films of this sort when I was small. I didn't see the actual films until quite a bit later.
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw them in the cinema particularly. Yeah. But to me it's that kind of film, and that's like Towering Inferno, just all that stuff. Just to me, it's sort of part of the furniture of my life, and so it's hard to be completely objective about it. But I think. That's a tricky one. I think maybe, can we say half a masterpiece? Because it just gets it all right, and it does it well, and it works.
It's doing a not terribly impressive thing very well.
Yes, I think that's it, really. It's hard to find it laudable. And it doesn't really do anything, you know, Jaws, you could argue is a similar thing, but it does it all so differently and so bloody well, and it's so well edited, and it's so fresh. And here it's kind of a mixture of older films and the new coming in, and it.
I think it would be fair to say that Jaws, to some extent, is Spielberg's answer to the disaster film, as well as all the other things we've talked about.
Yes,
He's certainly starting, and he doesn't have the classic. Here is a small group of people that you care about, in quite the same way. Because the small group of people that you care about is the people who are trying to go out and do something about it.
Yes,
not the victims.
Oh, well, it sort of half turned into a disaster movie halfway through, Jaws, but you've had the whole first half of the film. Anyway, we're not talking about Jaws. We have talked about Jaws, if you want to look at that further. And that I still remain as fond of that now as I was back then. Here, The Poseidon Adventure, it feels like this is...
I'm not likely to go out and watch it next week, but I can certainly see myself watching it again in a
year. Yeah, well, it's DNA. I mean, talking about Jaws, one of my favourite ever films... It's for Poseidon Adventure's DNA, you're right, is in Jaws. It's there. So I'm gonna say half a masterpiece because it was very influential and
yeah, I've got to go along with that.
Well, there we are.
Confuse the stats.
I've got a way of putting it in the spreadsheet, don't worry. Well, there we are, The Poseidon Adventure. It's time to capsize this podcast, I think, Roger. Unless we want to do a Beyond the Poseidon Adventure, we're not going to do.
Glob.
Cheerio.